Welcome to Comics in Conversation, everyone. My name is Jordan Calhoun, and I'm here with my guest, syndicated cartoonist, author, creator of the Mama's Boy comic strip, award-winning trailblazer, everything, Jerry Kraft. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right. Really, really love your work. Really appreciate you spending the time to be here. And the first thing I wanted to dive in was I was reading The Big Picture, which is one of your Mama's Boy's books. And at the end of that book, there's something called My Life in Comics, and it's facetiously subtitled A Tale of Terror by Jerry Kraft. I want to see if you can walk me through sort of that story for listeners, because it's like the quintessential story of black nerd problems. Like, it really just totally resonated with me, and I read it 3 times in a row. So could you walk me through what that comic is about?
Yeah, you know, at the end of each of my Mama's Boys books, and I've done 3 of them, I like to have just like a whole separate, more comic book story. And this one, I was like, you know what, let me actually do a kind of my life. I think I'd originally done it for a project that John Jennings was doing. And, you know, it starts out with the fact that I just always loved comics, you know, as far as I can remember. And the image I used was having me in the crib and having little one of those little mobiles around, and instead of little shapes and stuff, it had, like, you know, Hulk and Daredevil and Spider-Man. I remember the first comic strips I ever did. My brother was stationed in Okinawa as a Marine, and I used to go see all these different movies, and especially karate movies, and then I would come home and, you know, illustrate those, you know, basic stick figures, and then send them to him. And that was probably the first comic strips that I ever did. Then I remember me and my friends Kenny and Pierre and Michael Green, we'd go out on the street and we'd pretend that we were Spider-Man and a Hulk and, you know, different superheroes like that, some of the X-Men. And, you know, that was because back in the day, that was before Xbox and, you know, Xbox One and PS4, where you actually got to be these superheroes and control them. And, you know, we didn't have the Avengers movies and all that.
Yeah, that's when you go outside and play X-Men and you call, like, I'm Wolverine, I'm Nightcrawler. Everybody.
You get the fingers out like the claws and, oh, you can't hurt me because I'm Colossus. And you got, oh, yeah, well, I got Adamantium.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, that was actually fun back then, you know. Like I said, I mean, I've got 2 sons now, teenage sons, and, you know, they've got the Xbox and all that. So, you know, I've never seen them going out there to pretend to be that, unless it was like maybe Halloween. And then, you know, it came time to start talking about careers, and I just always loved to draw. And back in the day, the term starving artist was like a really big thing, and that's all my parents really knew. And they were like, oh man, he wants to draw comics for a living. He is going to live in our basement until he's 50.
He's never going to launch.
Exactly. And, you know, so then, you know, as I got older, you know, starting to really look for any characters that looked like me and my friends. And, you know, they had Black Panther, who was pretty cool. But actually, back in the day, I could not really relate to him as well. You know, being a 12, 13-year-old from Washington Heights, which is just above Harlem. You know, I mean, Black Panther was African from Wakanda. It wasn't somebody growing up in Harlem, and I didn't really have that connection with Africa back then. Mm-hmm. So he was as different to me as, you know, some of the white characters. In fact, I probably felt more in tune with Peter Parker being a teenager who, you know, kind of sort of fit in, but kind of didn't.
Right.
So I think I felt more in line with him and, you know, some of the other characters. You know, then you started getting Black Goliath and Black Lightning, and, you know, Luke Cage and people like that. So, you know, I started picking up those books whenever I could. I liked them, never loved them. You know, there was just something about them that they just weren't as cool as you know, Black Bolt you know, the Fantastic Four and the Silver Surfer, you know, they couldn't shoot beams out of their eyes. They couldn't fly without suits, you know, and I did this cartoon a few years ago, creating the black superheroes of my, confronting actually the black superheroes of my childhood that I put up on YouTube. And it was just all about how, you know, Superman could do all these different things, you know, he cold breath and heat vision and this and that. And, you know, basically our guys were strong, but like I said, none of them could really fly. None of them could really shoot beams. So as a 12-year-old, there just didn't have that real cool factor, you know. As I got older and, you know, it's time to go to high school, I took the test for music and art and art and design in New York City. And again, my parents were still thinking that it was a phase that I would grow out of. So when it came time to go to college, by then I was old enough to make my own decision. And I found out about the School of Visual Arts in Manhattan. And that's where I applied and went for 4 years. And that's where I graduated. So that was really the start of me officially becoming an artist.
Now, let me pause you right there and just ask a question. When you were getting into SVA and you were planning on doing comics, did you think, looking back on it now, did you think that you were under some misconceptions on how easy it would be to create these characters and to break into the industry, or were you prepared for the long haul and prepared for the challenges that were ahead? Like, what was your mindset at that stage?
You know, I really didn't know the industry at all. So I think there was a part of me that thought that I would walk into Marvel and Stan Lee would be
we've been waiting for you.
Yes. Right, you know, the chosen one, and go to shake my hand, and you know, and then you know, just hand over Silver Surfer or Micronauts or, you know, whatever I was reading at the time, and that was it. The strangest thing that happened was, I guess that's what, you know, 500 other people at SVA who are cartooning majors decided. And, you know, they majored in cartooning. And because of that, they got to pick the classes first. So by the time, you know, it was my turn, all of the cartooning classes were always
taken. What was
it
you were majoring in?
Each year, you had to... like the first year was the foundation year. So that was like painting and media communications and sculpture and drawing and, you know, photography. So you really got a foundation for a little of everything. And then the next year you had to choose between fine arts and graphic arts or media arts. And I ended up, believe it or not, since I was not fast enough to get into any of those cartooning classes, I ended up taking a foundation class in advertising copywriting. And that was something that I also always liked to do. And I always had people say to me, you know, you'd be good, you know, in advertising, like doing those jingles and stuff like that. There was that old TV show Bewitched where Darren used to come up with these advertising slogans. And that always kind of resonated. I was like, hey, you know, that actually would be kind of cool. And then I also thought of that as probably more of a viable career option, you know, because they had so many ad agencies and things like that. And I was like, hey, you know, this could kind of be the best of both worlds. I could be creative and have fun, and I could also eat regularly, you know, and, you know, move out of my parents' basement and all that stuff that they had feared. So I ended up majoring in copywriting, much to the surprise of everybody. So that's what I did. And then, so the first few jobs I had out of SBA were at small ad agencies where I would write radio commercials, a few TV commercials. And then one of the things that I positioned myself is when I was in SBA, there were some really incredible artists. I mean, really incredible artists. And I was like, oh, I can't mess with that. But there were a few of them that were great artists who could write a little bit, but there weren't any writers who could draw as well as I could.
Okay.
So I positioned myself as a writer who could draw well, as opposed to an artist, right, who could write. And so that's what I did. I was a copywriter for about 8 years. I worked for two different smaller agencies, you know, building up the portfolio. And then the ad business basically just collapsed. It just really tanked. And now all of a sudden, instead of me going on job interviews against other junior writers, all of a sudden I was going up against, you know, I'd see one of my teachers from SBA who was now looking for work. And I'm like, oh, wow. Man. So I went back to SBA at the placement office, and there was a woman. There was actually a position open for a comic book assistant. And I was like, hey, you know, I could do that. And I'm thinking, you know, this is finally it. I kind of backed into this. And they're going to say, yeah, you know, we need somebody to draw Spider-Man's uniform or the background. And the woman answered, and she's like, yeah, you know, I'm doing this book, and it's kind of like Archie, but set in ancient Rome. And I was like, Archie? Ugh. So luckily, I had some old Archie comics that were my brother and sister's. And that entire weekend, I just made a whole new portfolio of drawing all those characters. And when I went in to the interview on Monday, I basically got the job. And it was working with a woman named Barbara Slate. And she had written this series called Sweet 16, which is Marvel had a short-lived girls line. And like I said, it was Archie set in ancient Rome, like that kind of look. And we did like 7 issues of those for Marvel. We did, I worked with her on 2 graphic novels called Yuppies from Hell and Sex Lives and Mutual Funds of Yuppies from Hell. And then some New Kids on the Block, which if you're not old enough to remember, it was one of the first boy bands.
Oh, I remember. I was young, but I remember.
So I worked on that for a few years. And then, you know, built up my portfolio. And then it was time to move on. And then I looked to see what else was out there.
So then what did you move on to?
I found that King Features, because I had always sent King Features, which is a newspaper comic strip syndicate, I had sent them copies of Mama's Boys, and the guy that was heading the comic art department, his name was Jay Kennedy, actually took the time to write me a note saying, hey, keep up the good work.
Was this, so you were submitting to several syndicates, including King, or you were just focused on King?
King, Universal, United, probably Tribune.
Okay, so you were shopping out Mama's Boys to several different syndicates, and right. They were kind enough to give you sort of input, like some feedback. Was it?
Only King Features gave me the feedback.
And this was in the form of a rejection, but it was one of those polite, like, try back again later suggestions?
It was a form letter with a handwritten note that said, hey, you're not quite there yet, but, you know, don't give up. Like, don't quit your day job yet, but don't give up drawing yet either. So I had gone back to SVA, and there in the placement office, I saw that the guy from King Features, Jay Kennedy, was looking for an intern. And even though I thought that I was kind of too old and too, I basically thought my interning days were behind me. But I was like, hey, you know, this is a great way to break in. This is the guy that wrote me that note. So I went and applied, and it was only one day a week, but I got the job. And there I, you know, would go in the back where they had all the comic strips, and I could see the originals of, you know, Phantom and Beetle Bailey and Hagar the Horrible and, you know, all these other Prince Valiant. And to actually really look at and study, you know, the lettering, the humor, the inking, just all that stuff. It was really like when you talk about being a kid in a candy store.
Right.
So I went from basically working one day a week, and then I got a part-time thing working 3 days a week, and then I went 5 days a week, and then that became a full-time job.
Over the course of how much time?
In the course of about 3 years, it probably went from intern to full-time job. And a buddy of mine, who were still friends, he was in the comic art department also. His name is Jim Keefe. And he eventually took over doing the Flash Gordon comic strip. And now he's the illustrator for the Sally Forth comic. So we both kind of, you know, weaseled our way in there. When I was showing Mama's Boys around, eventually I got it picked up for the King Features weekly service that was distributed to a ton of papers across the country. And I stayed in that service, the weekly service, for probably about 15 years. Doing the Mama's Boy strip.
So all the while that you were doing that, those 3 years sort of as intern and making that transition to full-time job, you were still working on Mama's Boys, you were still editing it, and when did it get picked up in that timeline?
Well, when I was there, King Features, I was also fortunate enough, they had at the time, I don't know how many since then, but the only African-American comics editor at any of the syndicates, a guy named Paul Hendricks. And he took me aside and gave me some tips on how to reposition Mama's Boys, because it was actually called something different. It wasn't Mama's Boys at the time. And it was more of a group of teenagers as opposed to two brothers. And he was like, yeah, you know, maybe you should make them brothers and bring in a mom. And, you know, what's the backstory? What do they do? You know, don't do anything that is, you know, don't go for the traditional, you know, mom's a school teacher or a nurse, which, you know, a lot of black women in sitcoms and, you know, books and things like that,
right,
they were
right.
Used to be a nurse or something like that. So I had her owning a bookstore, and then I made the main two characters brothers, and I brought in a grandfather and an uncle, and really worked hard to shape the characters and shape the comic into something that was different and something that I could be proud of.
So then when you got the comic, it was syndicated through King. Talk about trying to get the word out and trying to get people to notice and read and pay attention to the comic.
Yeah, I had started by self-syndicating, and I went to the library and got a list of black newspapers throughout the country and sent out samples and got picked up. I ran in the City Sun out of Brooklyn for a while. You know, the St. Louis American, the Houston Sun, Broward Times down in Florida. So that was the first of really starting to go national on my own. And it was kind of cool getting feedback from them. You know, comic strips in our community were not, I don't know if they ever really got the attention that it deserved. I think Boondocks is probably the first one where a lot of people were like, there are black comic strips out there. You know, even though people like Maury Turner and Brunson Brandon and Ted Shearer had done it, you know, since the 50s and 60s. And then the next wave was Barbara Brandon and Ray Billingsley, Stephen Bentley, Rob Armstrong. You know, those guys came. And that was, you know, way before Boondocks. And I remember coming up with another version of a comic strip. By this time I was married. I had moved to Connecticut. And I wanted to do something that was autobiographical of basically moving from, you know, uptown Washington Heights to the suburbs. You know, King Features was interested, and they're like, hey, this is pretty good. And then when I was there, I saw a submission for the Boondocks. And I was like, uh-oh, because I know that, you know, it's almost like Highlander mentality.
Only room for one of you guys.
Just room for one of us. And, you know, if I didn't speed up production and you know, get in front of the people I needed to before that launched, I knew that it probably would be years until that happened. Because, you know, there can be 10 strips about dogs and 10 strips about cats and, you know, suburban families. But when there are black comic strips, it's like, oh, well, this is just like Boondocks. Well, how? I mean, because Mama's Boys, I created Mama's Boys in 92. And Boondocks came out, I don't even remember, maybe 98, you know? So I'd been only been doing it for 6 years. And I get to show it. I would show it and like, oh, this is just like Boondocks. I'm like, you know, my characters.
It's not.
Right. My characters are 18 and 16. They live in, you know, like a Brooklyn kind of area. They run a bookstore. You know, there is a grandfather, there's an uncle. But, you know, they're teenagers in high school. And Boondocks was much different. The kids are younger. It had more of an edge. You know, mine had more of a family thing. But then when I was showing the new strip, the autobiographical one, then that was too much like Boondocks. Oh, well, it's about black people leaving the city and living in the suburbs. Like, yeah, but mine is a married couple, and there's a socioeconomic thing, there's a class issue, there's a this issue.
Service value, what you see when you look at it, is
black people moving from the city to the suburbs or the Boondocks.
Yep, and that's the end of sentence. There's not really much more that some people are willing to read into once you get that far.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I had so much over the years, like, oh, well, this is just like Herb and Jamal, because there was that one thing where, you know, Jamal played basketball. Now you have Yusuf playing basketball. Or this is too much like Curtis, because Yusuf goes to the barbershop and Curtis goes to the barbershop.
How did you, just to pause the story here, how did you deal with that frustration? Did you generally have a retort to that, or did you just shake your head and sort of internalize it and feel frustrated?
Probably a lot more of the latter, the frustrated part, because there were things that I realized I had absolutely no power over. You know, when I was sending it out, you know, I had an editor say, oh, well, you know, this is, the kids live in such a bad neighborhood. So, you know, this kind of shit wouldn't fly like in Iowa or somewhere, you know, or Minnesota.
Yeah, we always want that Iowa demographic.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, then I would look at the samples. I'm like, okay, In this strip, they're in their living room. Here they're in the bookstore. Here they're in school. Bookstore, school. I'm like, okay, so where's the bad neighborhood? You know, I'm looking through, like, did I do one when they're in the crack house? You know what I mean? Like, did Yusuf come home shot once? Was he flipping gang signs?
I don't remember writing it, but it's in here somewhere.
Apparently it is. I must have done that invisible ink thing. If you hold it up to a black light, you know, like playing those old albums backwards, they'd say, oh, there's a different message. So I'm like, maybe I did that. And so when I wanted to do a book, and I was still naive enough that I thought somewhere, you know, Stanley or someone was still waiting with that check for me. And I sent it out to different publishers, and I got rejection letter. And then one day I got one that had a handwritten note, and it said, and you know, last time I got a handwritten note, it was good.
Right.
I was like, hey, cool. And this one basically said, we're not interested in that kind of good time style of humor. So basically, you know, take a hike. And I was like, I was really offended because I was like, really good times? Like, if you had said The Cosby Show or Fat Albert or something, but good times, you know, it's all about the struggle. And I mean, they never did have any good times. You know, everything was just so, you know, hey, it's Ned the Wino, and it's welfare, and it's unemployment, yeah, and
it's a comedy about survival.
Yeah, and you know, it was all about insults, and, oh, Thelma, you so ugly, this, and, oh, JJ, you so stupid, and I'm like, that wasn't what I wanted to do at all. But if these are the people who are in charge of finding new material, and they clump my stuff in with good times, then it was hopeless. It really was. It was then that I said, I have no chance of ever getting this stuff or many of the things that I do picked up by a major publisher.
Did you start to question your work then, thinking that maybe this was... Like, did you think you were the crazy ones, or they were the crazy ones for how they were perceiving the story that you were trying to tell?
I thought they were the crazy ones because I was getting fan feedback. You know, I had contacted the American Diabetes Association because I wanted to work with them because I wanted the strip to be more than just humor. And I had gotten a newsletter saying how diabetes is running rampant in the Black and Latino communities. And I called them up and I showed them samples. And I said, you know, I never explained why there was no dad in Mama's Boys. Now, I had done it that way purposely because when I was growing up, most of my friends were raised by their mom or their grandmother. I was one of the few that had my mom and dad living with me. So I wanted to do a comic that gave props to these moms that were raising boys, you know, like some of my friends. And, you know, I got great feedback, you know. And like I said, the American Diabetes Association picked me up as spokes characters. And I was like, you know, this isn't good times. So, again, I went to the library, and I found a book on how to self-publish. And I read up about, you know, getting the ISBN number and the barcode and the copyright and the Library of Congress number. And I said that I am going to do a book that is going to look as good as any of these books that were put out by Angus McNeil or some of these other ones. And so it was in 1997 that I published my first Mama's Boys book called Mama's Boys as American the Sweet Potato Pie. And I started doing book fairs and, you know, things like that to get the market out, to get the word out and expand my market.
No, I'm glad you mentioned that, because there was a section in the comic about your life where cracked me up. There's a part where you're at a book convention or a comic book convention, and you're sitting behind your booth, and you're yelling at a guy, another black person, and it's pretty. The scene is about the African American reception to your work and getting African American support for the comics that you're making, and you're yelling this dude like, "Yo, like black comics over here, like you want to, you know, you want to read this, you want to look at it," and he's just covering his face, sort of just like, you know, just casually walking away.
Just like I'm coming after him with a tin cup.
Yeah, exactly. And he's like, I'm just gonna keep wandering over here. So tell me what you were trying to convey in that scene, and sort of your experience at conventions and book fairs and self-publishing and trying to garner support and readership for your work.
Well, you know, my buddy David Walker, who is now writing the Shaft comic, and he's done some great things.
That comes out in December, right?
Yes. Yeah.
We'll be reviewing that. I think I'll be reviewing that on Black Nerd Problems.
Oh, cool. Yeah, he's a good guy. And, you know, it's sometimes a man without a fan base, you know, where, like, I have done book fairs or fairs, you know, like the old Black Expo kind of deal, or Circle of Sisters. And, you know, I've got these children's books, you know, wholesome images, you know, I like to think good stories, good art. And, you know, you get the pats on the back and, brother, our kids need you, and thank you for, you know, what you're doing for the community. And, or people that will come up and ask, talk to me for a half hour on how to publish their own book, whatever, and then leave and not purchase anything. Or I was at Circle of Sisters a few years ago, and this family, mom, dad, two daughters, and the boy. And the boy's like, "Hey, dad, you've been buying stuff for the girls all day. You know, when are you gonna get me something?" And he goes, "Okay, all right, you know, you're right." So he starts walking over towards my table, and the father says, "No, you don't want to go over there. All they got is books."
Wow. Wow.
And then I did Harlem Week, and the sister comes up to me. You know, I'm all happy. I got my first Mama's Boys book. And she goes, "I already know why I'm not buying this book." "Okay, and why is that?" "Because this word right here." "Like American, because as American as sweet potato pie?" "That's right, because, you know, with this country and our foreign policy and blah, blah, blah." And I'm like, wow. So you're going to start the boycott with me.
Raging against the machine of Jerry Craft and his wholesome black family.
Right. It's like, take down Jerry Craft, take down Al-Qaeda. You know, and or, you know, George Bush's policies and stuff. I'm like, really? And I've had so much of that over the years. Oh, well, you know, you call yourself trying to help kids and you spell boys with a Z. You know, what's that about? I wouldn't buy my book just because of that. I'm like, do you shop at Toys R Us?
That backwards R.
Yeah, like, are you writing them to say, "Hey, you know, I'm not going to shop here because, you know, you guys are illiterate. You got a backwards R." But all of a sudden, my stuff is held to, and I won't even say a higher standard, because I don't mind being held to standards. We should be held to standards, because, you know, I get on aspiring comic book guys and cartoonists all the time, you know, for not having their stuff edited. And, you know, you give me stuff with spelling errors, or, you know, the thumb is on the wrong side of the hand. I'm like, come on now, you know, can't be doing something like that. But, you know, these people to me are just making up stuff. Just, I'm going to be outraged.
Right.
You know, and then when you go, to book fairs where it's predominantly white audience, then you're the black guy. And it's like, oh, I don't want my daughter reading that, because next thing, you know, first she starts reading Mama's Boys. Next thing, she's listening to Snoop Dogg. And
it's a slippery slope.
Right. Absolutely. Slippery slope. So, and then when you see some of the black families at these cons, and it's predominantly white, and this is the thing that David Walk and I talk about a lot, is they know that if they make eye contact, there's that obligation
to walk over. Yeah.
To walk over. So in turn, many of them won't even look at the your table, because it's like, oh, you know, it's like a, you know, you get closer, and then like the rope goes around your ankle and pulls you up.
Yeah, yeah. I think a good analogy you used was the tin cup. Like, if you see someone and you make eye contact who's sort of down on their luck and seems destitute, if you sort of engage, if you look like you're making some type of connection with them, then right. You're gonna feel guilty if you don't go over there.
Absolutely. And then and this is one of the reasons why I appreciate what you're doing, because, you know, you have the black nerd problems, but it's not all about Batman and Marvel and DC. And I think that a lot of people will say, you know, we want to be recognized because, you know, we're black cosplayers, or we're black this, we're black that, but distance themselves from the black independent. And it's like, yeah, but, you know, we would love that stuff. I would love for you to dress up
right.
as one of the characters. Mm-hmm. Don't always, and, you know, not slamming them. Nothing wrong with, if you want to dress up like Storm or Black Panther, that's fine. But don't completely ignore the independent, because we're in the same boat as you.
Right.
And sometimes you get so upset, like, oh, well, I want to dress up as Batman, and someone got mad at me and said, well, you shouldn't be dressed up like Batman because Batman's white. Well, I mean, that's the risk you take sometimes, you know.
When you were going through this process and you were promoting Mama's Boys and your different works, where were the communities, where were the places that you went for support? Who were the people that really did support you and patronized your work and helped promote? Who were the people that showed you love during that time?
Well, it wasn't the comic book people. Like, I still to this day do very few comic cons.
Why is that?
You know, because I don't really do the superhero thing. And I think a lot of times when you do the comic cons, they're looking for the superhero
stuff.
Yeah,
it seems sort of synonymous in a lot of people's minds, comics and heroes.
And so even the first few years when I would go up to Ekbok in Philly, I just did miserably, because they were looking for, you know, Brother Man and, you know, Machindo stuff, who is amazing, and I get that. But over time, I kind of grew into that mold and made a place. So now I do have people that come looking for me, as, you know, I guess an alternative to the super powered stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that's one of the things. So I started doing more book fairs, and that really started taking off. But, you know, what was interesting is I had done the Mama's Boys book for people like you and me, who were, you know, adults that like comics, and people would come over and they say, hey, can I get this for my kid? I'm like, how old is he? 8? I was like, well, I guess. Like, you know, there was nothing bad in it, but I just never thought of it as a kid's thing.
Yeah, they weren't your target audience.
Yeah, and they'd come back over and like, dude, my son got your book, sat in the corner of the book fair, and just read the whole thing cover to cover. He loves it. I was like, really? And more, it started becoming something that the kids were buying. Or parents were buying for their kids. So when I decided to do the second book in 2007, I didn't change the humor in it at all because I didn't want it to be like, oh, there's a kid's book now, so I've got to put, you know, dumb down the humor.
If it was working for kids how you wrote it the first time, then that's the formula you probably want to keep.
And that, to me, was the best thing I could have ever done was... do it for us and then kids like it, as opposed to, like I said, oh, I'm going to do a kids comic. But what I did end up doing was putting a section on how I draw, putting little notes on that. I did like a little flip book and things like that. And then the kids were losing their mind because they love that stuff. So that was when it really started to take off. And then the second book always helped sell the first book. Mm-hmm. And then I did the third book, Mama's Boys, The Big Picture, where now I had my first female readers, because now libraries were buying it. So with the first one, Sweet Potato Pie, it was 99% black boys who got the book as gifts or whatever. With the second book, libraries started to get it, so I started to get some girls, you know, different kinds of people. I started getting some Latino fans. By the third book, I had to recognize that now I had a really diverse audience.
Yeah, following. That had to be a good feeling.
Yeah, and you know, it's, again, it's scary because, you know, how do I reward my diverse audience by adding characters that now look like them without being called out by my community? Because, you know, we the first ones to be, oh, look, now we got white characters. You know, well, what's up with Lori Kraft now? You know, where'd the white girl come from? Why they gotta be a white girl? Mm-hmm. Like, dude, have you bought any of my books? Well, no. Well, all right then.
Have you genuinely been accused of that? Like, has anyone ever really questioned that from you?
So I am always so nervous of that because I have had so many friends, author friends, that that do that or have had to do that because, you know, it's a business, you know, and if you guys don't buy my books, then yeah, I may be working at Walmart next week greeting people. I won't be happy. I'll be the meanest greeter. Hey, didn't I used to do Mama's Brother? Shut up. Anyway, serial aisle 5. You know what I mean?
You want my kindness, you could have bought my book last month.
Say, I've been really kind. I'm like, you asked me to give your kids drawing lessons, and you asked me to come to your school, and you said I was a pillar to the community, but, you know, you wouldn't shell out $10, but you bought your son a $80 Call of Duty game, and then wonder why he doesn't like to read. I'm like, well, you didn't give him stuff that he liked to read.
Yeah.
You know, so because of that kind of stuff, I've always been, you know, I mean, I know people that are like, hey, you know what, these books aim towards our community, not getting it done, not paying the rent, you know, so sometimes they have to, you know, you gotta add more. Or I've known people that have just said, hey, I'm gonna do a book about a, you know, 13-year-old white boy with red hair who lives in such and such a place, mm-hmm. because they need to eat.
So,
you know?
Yeah, definitely. But changing gears for a little bit, now during this whole journey of your career, you got married, you had a couple kids, And I was curious how much your kids inspire your work, or how much they inform your work sort of differently now that you're a parent and you've watched your kids grow up and the climate that they're growing up in, and now they're teenagers. I know you did a book with one of your kids, The Offenders. So how did your kids start coming into play in your work?
Yeah, not too much.
No?
No, I'm kidding. It's so funny because with Mama's boys, Yusuf and Tyrell, all right, they're 2 years apart, and the youngest one is a real people person. You know, he's a dancer, he's a ball player. The older one is a little more shy. And my sons are so much like the Mama's Boys characters. So it's really life imitating art. And it's really funny that when I sat down and thought about it, I was like, wait a minute. My sons now are 2 years apart. And, you know, the youngest one is more in your face and, you know, this happened, that happened. So it was really kind of funny. Now, regardless of what I did, their approval has always been really important with what I do. So I have never taken any projects that I can't show them. You know, so you won't see me doing Jerry Crafts, you know, Thug Lovin' Part 3 or any of that stuff, because, you
I
know.
had hopes, but
Yeah, I know, I know. Maybe under a pseudonym.
yeah, there we go. There we go. You always can use a pen name.
Yeah, I was thinking of maybe Jordan Calhoun as a as...
As long as you send that money my way when it sells.
So I would write some stuff, and you know, when I was younger, I really didn't like to read at all. I read Marvel comics, and you know, that was the devil's doing back when I was a kid. So you know, teachers always confiscate your books. So I really didn't like to read anything but comics. And then when I got older, you know, I could read manuals really well. Like if you give me a manual back in the day on HTML or Photoshop or Dreamweaver, and I could read that cover to cover, no problem. But I just really rarely ever sat down reading a book for enjoyment. So I had thought of the idea for The Offenders, and when the kids would go to school, you know, I would always talk. We'd be in the car, and I'd say, hey, you know, I'm thinking about this, 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 and this. So when they'd go to school, you know, I'd work on it, or sometimes I'd work through the night because I've always been a night owl, and I would read them some stuff. So, you know, my life reading to them is like, oh, Dad, that's great, and everything you do is great, and that is great. And then they got to be that certain age where, especially my oldest one, I'd read him something, he'd go, wait, hold on, Dad. Read that last line back? Nah, no 13-year-old kid would do that.
So then they got to be, they became a part of critiquing your work.
Yeah, and I'm like, you know, hey, you know what? Go to your room and no Xbox tonight. And once I put my ego aside, I was
Like,
like,
they're actually a useful resource.
right, and they're free.
That's right.
Even better, you know. And I was like, well, wait a minute. All right, so what would he say? You know, oh, well, he'd say blah blah blah. I'm like, wow, that's actually pretty good. So with The Offenders, you know, it was right up their alley because it's about middle schoolers, and there's five kids, and you know, they get zapped doing something that they shouldn't, and they're kind of school bullies. But when they get zapped, they get these superpowers. But instead of turning into, you know, cool guys like Deadpool and Iron Man and Black Panther, they take the characteristics of the kids that they pick on. So one of them gets really overweight. One of the girls gets super, super thin, like spaghetti thin. One kid gets super smart, but physically really uncoordinated. The kid that snaps on kids with bracelets gets these two big metallic buck teeth, you know, kind of like Wolverine claws, but teeth. The girl that's always calling kids mousy shrinks down to the size of a mouse. So now they have to try to saved the school, but now they get dog for being, you know, different looking.
Right,
so,
right.
Karma thing. So, you know, my boys started adding so much to it that I listed them as co-writers because, you know, I didn't want to show my age and have the kids. And then they're sitting down playing Pong on their ColecoVision. You know, my son's like, look, you know, they're playing Call of Duty. He's a 10th level prestige. He's this. They're playing online. They do this. They do this. Or, you know, hey, this happened at school today, Dad. What do you think about this? And actually writing stuff. And like I said, before we knew it, it was a collaborative, total collaborative effort. And that was really because of working with them has become probably my favorite project ever. And now they come with me to do book signings. We just did one up at UConn last weekend. And then, you know, we've done some panels on getting boys to read and, you know, some school visits and things like that. So I've really enjoyed this next chapter, having them along.
That is absolutely awesome. And sort of speaking in that same vein, if you were to give advice to someone who wanted to follow your trajectory, your career path, what advice would you give them at, you know, say your kid's age or someone who is sort of young and trying to figure out their way in comics as a new creator?
You know, one of them is accept criticism. And this doesn't mean everyone that says something, you have to take it to heart. For example, you know, I do these cons a lot now. And I'll have younger artists come up to me and I'll say, hey, you know, I notice that you have a hard time drawing hands. And some of them, first thing they do is get defensive. No, I don't have no problem drawing hands. You know why? Why do you say that? I'm like, well, because I'm on page 8 of your comic book. And every single panel, the guy's hands are in his pocket or he's scratching his head. Or they're behind his back. To me, this is you hiding the fact that you don't draw hands well. So you need to practice. Here, I would even give you some tips. Some of them will take them. Some of them will continue to be, no, that's just a coincidence. I'm like, I don't think so. Because even like when I first got married, I would show my wife my Mom is Boy's comic strip. And sometimes she said, well, I don't get it. And I go, oh, and she go, but, you know, I'm not a cartoonist, so, you know, don't worry about what I think. And I'm like, well, I'm exactly worried about you, what you think, because cartoonists aren't my audience.
Right.
People are my audience. So if you don't get it, then I haven't done my job to make it that it's easily understandable. In The Offenders, one of the characters, Dexter Diaz, is Latino. And when I grew up in Washington Heights, you know, in the beginning when I was there on 162nd Street off of Amsterdam, it was primarily Black and Puerto Rican. As I got older, it was probably 90% Dominican, 10% Black. So when I created this character, I said, you know what, I don't want to do anything stereotypical. So I did the character, and then I had a couple friends, male and female, who are both Latino, and I said, I'm going to send you this book. Please read the chapters and let me know what you think. And they were like, hey, we like the story, but there were some basic things that you missed completely, that basically you got wrong. And I'm like, okay, well, what are they? You know?
Right.
And they set me straight, and I went back and I rewrote it until they were like, okay, now this is something that I would be proud of, or I would want my kids to read, or other Latino kids to read. So that whole advice thing is, do your homework, you know, do characters that you would like to see. You know, try to be original. Obviously, don't just say like, oh, I'm gonna do Black Spider-Man or, you know, Black Wolverine.
Right.
and find a style that's your own. You know, don't always copy the manga style or copy, you know, certain artists. You can be inspired by them, but definitely learn to draw different things. And also, you know, regular people, because not every book, you know, every scene is somebody in a superhero uniform. Sometimes they're, you know, they're alias, which is a doctor or, you know.
Yeah, a regular person.
Right, regular person.
That is good advice, good advice. I wanted to take 1 second before we wrapped up. I know you're helping coordinate the Black Comics Festival in January. Could you tell the listeners about that happening at the Schomburg Center?
So it started about 4 years ago. I was hanging out in Chicago with Turtel Only, and we said, you know, it'd be kind of cool to do a Black Comic Book Day where Turtel would do something in Chicago and I would do it in New York. So we went about finding venues, because one of his best assets is he's unselfish in the sense of, you know, knowing that we have to grow our marketplace. You know, it's not me against Jordan. It's, you know, me and Jordan. So they may not buy both of our books the same day, but if they buy your book today, they might say, hey, you know, I like these Black comic books.
Right.
Who else is out there? Oh, Jerry Craft's got one. You know, oh, Turtel's got one.
More a support system than a competition.
Right. And a lot of us still don't see it that way. We're still like trying so hard to get that $3. So, you know, you don't spend your $3 on Machindo's book, even though Machindo probably charges more for his books than I do, but he's worth it, I have to say. but you know what I mean?
Totally.
And so he did something, I believe, at the DuSable Museum. And I found a bookstore in Harlem, the Human Bookstore. And we're expecting 15, 20 people. We got like 100 people. Hugh Mann was like, oh my God, this is amazing. So the next year we had again, and we had even more people. By the time the third year came, unfortunately, they had to shut their doors. So we needed a new venue. I somehow got into conversation with the Schomburg about that. And they had already been approached by Jonathan Gale about doing some kind of a comic book thing that was more from an academic point of view, because he had the Black Superhero. Oh, man, his movie. I have to look that real quick. Black Superheroes. Oh, he's going to kill me. Jonathan Gale's. Anyway, I'll look that up.
We'll end up linking it with the podcast.
Yes, thank you.
No problem.
And great film. And then John Jennings had an idea for something. And Schomburg said, well, basically, we can't do all three. But, you know, is there a way that you guys can kind of White Scripts Black Superman? That's what it's called. White Scripts Black Superman.
Okay.
So can you guys kind of morph into one big Super Voltron kind of comic con where, you know, we all form together? And that's what we did. So we chose Martin Luther King weekend. And, you know, we're expecting a couple hundred people. We got 1,500 people.
Wow.
She was amazed. They were like, oh my God, we got 1,500 people. And so then we did it again last year. And, you know, I was nervous about asking people to come in from out of town with the first one, because I didn't know what to expect. So then last year, you know, we said, okay, listen, this popped off really good last year. So we had, you know, Machindo come up from North Carolina, and David Walker came from Portland, and the Ekba crew came from Philly. And we had Alex Simmons and different people doing different panels and things. Jennifer Crute, we had a Women in Comics panel, and we got like 2,500 people. And so we had an event Friday, which is kind of the kickoff. And then Saturday, we had the vendors. We had like, I don't even remember, maybe 40 different artists and writers of color with their tables. It's free admission, you know, for the fans. And it was literally packed the entire day. Many people were like, this is the best Comic-Con that we have been to, black, white, whatever. You know, and this is like some of the creators saying that. And the fan base is unbelievable. And these are people that are coming to buy. So they are not turning their head when they look at you like, oh, man,
I got to go to that. Yeah.
Because that's what we all are. And it's really cool because it's families, too. You know, it's people like yourself that you know, grew up reading comics, but now might have like an 8-year-old son. And it's like, dude, check this out. Look at this, you know. And even, you know, since we had some female cartoonists there, the little girls are coming in with their sketch pads, and we had some cosplay people. So it was really an amazing event. So we hope to, you know, recreate it again, recapture that magic. So it would be January 17th. It would be the Friday and Saturday of Martin Luther King weekend. So I will definitely blast it and let you know as we get closer to it.
Definitely. And I will 100% be there. I'll also link the website to this podcast. So if anyone is curious about attending, you can find information on it here. And just before we go, Jerry, how can fans find and support your work? Any social media that you're on, or Tumblr, or your website?
Yeah, the good thing is I keep it simple. So everything is Jerry Craft. So Twitter, it's Jerry Craft. My website, jerrycraft.net. So it's Jerry with a J, JerryCraft.net. My email, jerrycraft@aol.com. All those other Tumblrs and Instagram, Jerry Craft, nice and simple. And the one thing I do have to say is, you know, I had given up approaching the big publishers, like I told you. And last year, in August, out of the blue, I get an email from Scholastic saying, hey, would you like to illustrate a book for us? I thought I was being pranked. And I'm like, all these years where I, you know, it was so important to approach them. And now, because of, I guess, my track record, you know, luckily spoke something to someone. And now I had one of the largest children's book publishers in the world.
And that's the Zero Degree Zombie Zone,
written by Patrick Henry Bass from Essence Magazine. And I illustrated it. It came out in August of 2014, so a few months ago. And now we've done a few tours with that. So it's been great.
Man, congratulations on your success. Keep it up. You've done amazing work. I've enjoyed it. Like I said, you're a trailblazer for a lot of the people who are listening to this podcast right now, and for people like me. So really appreciate it. Keep it going. And thank you so much for being on the podcast with us. Really, really appreciate it.
You're welcome. I appreciate it. I appreciate the offer. Can't do it without you guys.
All right. So this is Comics in Conversation with our guest today, Jerry Craft. Thanks a lot for listening, and tune in next time.